You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
I've heard it said that cats are like potato chips. You can't have just one. But mixing flavors like the British turkey and stuffing variety with flaming Cajun American snacks could leave a strange taste in your mouth. If you're like me, you have multiple perpetrators of TV screen paw prints. Sometimes a clowder, a collective of cats, works, and sometimes it can have dire effects on your carpeting and sanity. The new book, Your Ideal Cat, co-authored by my guest, Dr. Ben Hart, board-certified veterinary behaviorist, and his wife, Lynette Hart, a professor of veterinary medicine and human-animal behavior, will tell us how we can keep perfect harmony in our homes. I know, that was sick, but my cats made me do it. All right, so sit, stay. We'll be right back after this short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Are you crazy about cats? If so, check out The World is Your Litter Box, Deluxe Edition. This clever how-to manual for cats, written by a cat named Quasi, contains more laughs than should be allowable in one book, and is poignantly underscored by the combative yet loving relationship between Quasi and his human. The World is Your Litter Box, Deluxe Edition, is guaranteed to have you laughing your tail off. So, treat yourself to a copy today. Available from Amazon.
Your dog digs a hole under your fence, and the next thing you know, protect your pets with Dig Defense, the amazing new product that keeps your pets in the yard. Dig Defense is safe, fast, and easy. Each unit is made from 4-gauge galvanized American steel and can be used for repairing digouts, filling gaps, or to hold fences down so pets can't get under them. Dig Defense provides peace of mind that your pets are contained humanely and safely. Visit digdefense.com today. DIGDEFENCE.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Hart, thank you so much for being with us today. I have to admit, you were one of my professors in veterinary school and taught me about behavior.
Well, that was one of my passions. You know, when California was the first school that started the behavior of dogs and cats as part of the official curriculum, and we got into behavior problems. So I've enjoyed that, teaching that for a long, long time.
And California is such a trendsetter. Good for us, because behavior is such an important aspect. I know behavior that people don't like, why their pets end up at shelters, why they are abandoned. Now, would you say the same thing hold true for cats?
I would say that's probably true, but for different reasons than for dogs. Dogs end up probably in the shelter because of aggression problems. And mostly that's the leading one. And with cats, it's probably house soiling or furniture ripping up. And so somewhat different reasons that people would take an adult cat. And other times they just kind of put up with it. But you know, the research has been done by people looking at animals relinquished to shelters. They don't really study cats that much. It's all kind of focused on dogs.
And that is kind of sad. It seems like so much of veterinary medicine is really dedicated to dogs. Our medications are meant for dogs. And oh yes, by the way, you can use it on cats. And cats are the number one pet that is kept in the United States. There's more cats than there are dogs. And as I said, you know, at the beginning, cats really, most of us have multiple cats. But I know every time I bring a new cat into the household, I do it with dread because I know I'm going to have bent whiskers for a period of time. So really, cats are not solitary creatures. That's one of the myths I think people believe, is that they're only supposed to have one cat. They can't live in a group.
That's true. That's a misconception in some respects. But in other respects, actually, I would argue that they are solitary in their ancestry. And it's because the wild African cat, which is the ancestor of the domestic cat, really was a loner. So they become social because of our breeding and our raising them to some degree. But we've created breeds of cats that get along well, and then some that don't get along well. I mean, I could point out to you that a certain breed, let's say the Ragdoll, gets along very nicely, as far as I know. I don't have one, by the way, but this is from our book. Gets along very well with other cats. It doesn't get into fights. But the Bengal is not near as social with other cats in the household as the Ragdoll is. So we've influenced the sociality, if you will, of cats much more than we have in dogs.
Now, here we have all these various breeds, and we know that the Labrador was bred to be the working hunting dog. And then we had the Doxy, and that was going to be the one that would go to ground. And we have all these various cats. You're mentioning the Ragdoll, and then the Bengal, and then you have the Persian. Was it just on looks that people started breeding these? And you say it came from one main line of a wild cat.
That's a very good point. The dogs, when we look at their behavior as pets, it seems to reflect what their utilitarian basis was, what they were used for. They were used for retrieving game for hunters in the field, or for pointing, or for guarding, or for going after rats, you know, the ratting dogs, the barking dogs for using and hunting. And cats don't have that kind of utilitarian background. So the breeds really that developed are a reflection of the kind of the whims of or the desires of the people. They wanted the cat that looked a certain way, or they wanted one that behaved a certain way. They're developed along the lines that people actually chose, much more than utilitarian.
So to sit on your lap or not to sit on your lap is probably one of the starts. And yes, there are those that are out there. And you know, yes, when we had our agricultural background, they were ratters and kept the grain safe from the rats and all the other little rodents. So right now, how many different breeds are recognized, and kind of give us extremes of one to the other? So I'm looking for the perfect house cat to have around kids. What would you recommend? What's out there?
Okay, very good question. Let me tell you about the variety of cats. The exact number of cat breeds is kind of, it's not an easy answer to give you, because there are a number of cat registration organizations. There's American Cat Fancy Association, there's Cat Fancy International, and some other ones, and some recognize some breeds and some don't recognize other breeds. And there's some, I don't know, 80-something kinds of breeds, and some are so uncommon that even if you talk up a feline practitioner who just sees cats come and go all day long, they wouldn't recognize that breed. You couldn't talk about it very much. But the common ones, our book actually covers the 15 most common breeds of cats, plus the domestic short hair and domestic long hair. That said, and we started our study by interviewing feline practitioners over and over again, having them rank breeds of cats. We found that a couple of the extremes were the Ragdoll and the Bengal. And the Ragdoll, as you can imagine, is kind of a really friendly cat, loves to be held on your lap, is not aggressive, you know, greets visitors. You got someone that comes over to see you, they want one more person to pet him, as it were. And then the Bengal is not a friendly cat, does not like visitors so much. Now, I'm being general in this. Now, I don't want some of the listeners to feel that, well, look, I have a Bengal, it's different because there are breed differences, but I'm speaking in a general sense. They are much more like independent, they're aggressive, they're not near as affectionate, but they're beautiful. I mean, the Ragdoll kind of looks like a fluffy old Ragdoll, and a lot of variations in color. And Bengal is a breed that stems from what the developers of that breed thought looked like a wild leopard cat.
And, they're very exotic looking. I love them.
Yeah, they are. And the some people have even fixed up their house so they can have a more of a three-dimensional forest inside. But it's the one cat breed where the ancestor is the Asian leopard cat as well as the African wild cat basis. And so it's a hybrid, in fact, because the person who developed that breed in Southern California in the 60s loved the looks so much. That was when pet stores were selling these exotic pets. So they brought home, she brought home, an Asian leopard cat, bred it with some neighbors' short hair, and got what she thought was Asian leopard cat looking. And then she crossbred it again with some other cats she had around, and then had another Asian leopard cat sent to her from Asia, from a curator in a museum, in a zoological garden, I should say. And then they bred this cat again, so they've got something that really looks wildlife. And it's the looks, not the behavior, that attracts people to that cat. It's a very popular breed.
Now, the Bengal as well as a Savannah cat, those two, oftentimes it seems like they're closer to that wild cat in behavior. And I know you say it's more of looks, but it doesn't seem like they're that far removed genetically from their wild ancestors versus, say, the domestic short hair. Is that proper thinking?
Well, that's true. The Bengal is when the International Cat Fancy Association recognized it. I think it was four generations beyond the initial development of that breed. And so that's not very long, four generations. And it was looked at as if a cat is breeding true when you have second generation, third generation, fourth generation breeding with each other. And so the American Cat Fancy Association does not recognize the Bengal because it is not far enough removed from the ancestors. Whereas the common short hair, domestic short hair, is more of a generic breed. We refer to it as a short hair, but it's more of a generic. And it's been developed by, it's a number of mixtures from the Burmese and the Persian being there and the Siamese. And so it has a rather open-ended background, unless you're talking about the American domestic short hair, which was restricted in its breeding a long time ago. But the common domestic short hair is not a purebred. And so, but all of these cats are
the alley
quite
cat,
removed.
In other words.
Yeah, right, yeah. And, you know, all the cats, actually, the history of cat breed development goes back some, 10,000 years or so. I mean, we cover in our book the origins of the cats in the Asian area and the breed development and then moving across into Europe. And it's kind of an intriguing history of the development of cat breeds.
So the cats here in the United States, some of the original cats, came from Europe, came from Asia?
Yeah, they're from basically Western Europe as the same kind of grouping of cats that then made their way to the North American continent. And it was some of the first cats brought in were the generic kind of short hair or long hair type, came over with the initial settlers from Europe. And then, they were used as farm cats, of course. And then they kind of diversified themselves and became the short hair. And then, otherwise, you got the Burmese, you got the Siamese come in from the other parts of the world, and by then transportation was so great that they were moving all over.
Well, I love that there are such unique looks to all these animals, and behavior can also vary. And one of the questions that people will always have when they're talking about behavior is, okay, I have one cat, maybe I had two, one of them passed away. I just have to have another cat like a potato chip. Do I get two males? Do I have two females, young and old mixes? Is it possible to say, let's talk about sexes. It's better to have all females, all males in the house. Does that really make a difference?
Okay, well, that really is a good question. In our book, where we're ranking breeds of cats on behavior traits, we also rank the sexes. And it's just a bit of a surprise to me. I wasn't quite that clear on it. But the males, I talked about neutered males versus neutered females. Males are more affectionate and less aggressive than females and more outgoing to people than females are. And we're talking about aggression towards other cats. We're talking about aggression towards people. So lots of times, if it's the only cat you're going to have, I want to get my first cat. We like to have people think about a male cat because they are more outgoing, friendly, less aggressive to the people they're going to be interacting with. Now, the downside about males, as you know, is they are the ones that get into urine marking.
Yes. I agree with you. Probably the best cat I ever had, and I've had lots since I was a kid, because I am definitely a cat person. I've had my dogs, but I'm a cat person. The best one was a kitty named Zachary, a neutered male. He accepted everything that came into the house. And probably the disaster zone that I had was a male cat by the name of Bogey, who urine marked from the time that he was itty bitty and his little ears were screwed on too tightly was the best way to describe him.
Okay, so that's the thing. So if you have several cats already, and since it's the interactions between cats that's the most frequent, certainly not the only, but the most frequent trigger for urine marking is you bring a cat in and they have some agonistic interactions. They fight some. They don't like each other. You know, when you bring new cats in, that's the main trigger for urine marking in males. So females are much less predisposed. So if you already have three females there, and even though, you know, males and females scrap some, it's not that, you know, well, a male and female get along better, but it depends on the way they're just going to interact. Think about a female. If you already have a male and a female, think about bringing in a female. I say that simply because then every cat you bring in, the chance of evoking some sort of low level or even high level of aggression increases. And the urine markings, the result of that sometimes. It's only 10% of male cats that get in the urine marking, but that's still, that 10% of people stuck with that, it's a real problem.
But females can also urine mark, correct?
No, they absolutely can. When we've done our surveys or we've tried to recruit animals for testing of medications to treat urine marking, we find that we get about 8 males for every 2 females that are actually suggested or referred to us for our trials. So it's much easier to get male urine markers to cooperate in a clinical trial to test a new medication. And we've done a survey on this as well. It looks as males are about 5 times more likely than females to urine mark.
Well, I need to mark a passage right now. I'm speaking right now with Dr. Ben Hart, who's written a great book, Your Ideal Cat. So if you have one cat, need another, or have multiples and want to know what's going to not upset the mix and have some fur fly, we'll tell you more right after this short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Dog Shelter Blues, the new novel by Mark Conkling. This hard-hitting story lights up the world of animal rescue with engaging characters and their pets, struggling with their own internal demons as they attempt to rescue innocent creatures that sometimes bring a mysterious transforming power to broken lives. Read the first chapter of Dog Shelter Blues free at dogshelterblues.com. Then come along a breathtaking journey that ends with an astonishing triumph of good over evil. Order your copy of Dog Shelter Blues today. Available at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Hi, this is Tim Link, animal communicator and pet expert, and host of Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Have you ever wanted to know what your pet is really thinking? Do you want to find out if they truly understand what you're trying to tell them? Ever wish you could build a better understanding and closer relationship with your pet? Well, now you can. Learning to communicate with animals is a 4-part on-demand workshop. In the workshop, you'll learn the essential techniques that are necessary to communicate with animals, including what is animal communication, breathing correctly to achieve the perfect state to communicate with your animals at a deeper level, using guided meditation exercises as a method to communicate with animals, and how to send and receive information from your animals. So if you're wanting to learn how to communicate and connect with your animals at a deeper level, visit PetLifeRadio.com/workshop and purchase and download Learning to Communicate with Animals. You'll be glad you did.
Ever wonder what it would be like to live in a perfect world for cats? I'm Pamela Merritt from The Way of Cats, longtime cat rescuer, full-time cat appreciator. Join me and my cats James Bond, RJ, Olwen, and Tristan in a perfect world.
Every week on demand,
only on PetLifeRadio.com.
Let's talk pets. On Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Hart, this is really fascinating. There is really no book that I've ever seen where I could go and go, all right, this is the situation I have. What can I do? How can I add to my mix of kitties? You were talking about males and females, and it sounds like some neutered males really have some battle of the sexes won there. But how about mixing young and old cats? So many times we'll have a pet that passes. For instance, I have a 14-year-old kitty right now, and I have a 3-year-old. I thought, you know, this middle one or this younger one needs a friend. So I brought in a kitten. It's worked. There's those bent whiskers for about a month. But would you generally say it's a better idea to bring in a young one, a middle age, or if you have a senior, to bring in another senior?
Well, that's not a question I get asked a lot, so I'm going to give you kind of a thought-out answer, and that is that young cats, kittens, adapt more easily to a household situation. For example, if you have a dog, a kitten will adapt to getting along with that dog much better if you bring in an adult cat, especially if the adult cat has no experience with dogs. And so I imagine that you're going to have the same experience bringing in a kitten to adapt to the older one who has certainly, he or she has her own ways, you know, if she's 14 years old. So I would suggest a kitten rather than an adult cat.
Okay. And you're talking about adapting to new things in the house. What do you do, for instance, you have your ideal cat, and now you find your ideal new significant other, and it's just been you and the cat. How do you get your cat used to this new person in your life?
Oh, my. Well, in the behavioral field, it's always gradual. Gradual is what works best. You don't kind of force yourself on the cat. You let the cat come up, explore you, or explore the new person, smell, get some treats, and just kind of gradually work towards that goal. And because if you push yourself or they push themselves on the cat, then that tends to evoke anxiety more. And you don't know if they're going to growl, be aggressive, go away, hide, whatever. So it's a gradual approach with some reinforcement or rewards for movement in the right direction.
And that's probably a reward to the person and to the pet, too. Good person, good kitty. Okay, we can do this.
There you go. Right, yeah. So I want to mention something. We were talking about urine marking. Mm-hmm. And we're in male versus females. But it's also true that breeds of cats differ. And we didn't know we would find this when we started our study. But I can tell you right now that according to interviews with 80 feline practitioners who rank breeds of cats, and they also rank the domestic short hair and domestic long hair along with them, they ranked the number one most likely to urine mark in the house is domestic short hair. Then the Bengal, and then the domestic long hair, and then the Siamese. So those are the ones with the highest probability, according to our experts, of urine marking in the house when you bring one in.
Is it just because domestic short hairs are so common?
It's because of their background. Not that they're so common, no. They were looked at from the standpoint of what they know about that breed. It's just that domestic short hair, the way they've been bred and developed, there's some Siamese with them. There's some Abyssinian, other cat breeds in the background. They are just the number one. The Bengal is a very close second for most in urine marking. So of the purebreds, the Bengal's the number one urine marker. And then you get the Siamese, and you get the Persian, you get the Abyssinian. Okay, now look on the other side of this. Who is least likely to urine mark? According to your expert.
Oh, that's a good one.
All right.
A stuffed cat, but other than that.
It's the Sphinx. Do you know what the Sphinx looks like? It's a hairless cat.
Yes.
It's a Sphinx, and I often think, why is the Sphinx? Because it kind of looks like, hard to predict the behavior from the looks of that cat, but it's the least likely. Maybe they just, without hair, they're just too embarrassed to urine mark or something, I don't know. But that's the Sphinx. And then the Cornish Rex, and then the Ragdoll, and the Burmese. So those are least likely to urine mark. So if you've got three cats in your house already, you want to bring one in, you want to bring it as a kitten or an adult, and you say, the last thing I want is any more urine marking in my house, I would suggest a ragdoll if you want a friendly interactive, non-aggressive cat. Or if you say, wow, I like the looks of that sphinx, you know, I'd love to have one of those weird-looking cats in my household, you know, that's one you could bring in as well.
What are some of your tips for keeping cats from urine marking? So keeping them in that litter box. One of the things I always tell people, and one of the first questions I ask is, how many boxes? Are they open or closed? What kind of litter? And probably the most important question, at least in my mind, is how often do you clean the box?
Oh, you're absolutely right. And experience of, you know, behavior experts over and over again show that the most common factor related to not using the litter box is they're not cleaning it enough. And remember, you know, cats have their olfactory powers are much greater than ours, and they get much closer to the box than we get with their nose. So they like a litter box that smells a bit like a toilet area. In other words, if it's all clean, it's still going to have some smells, residual smells of a toilet area because of the plastic and so forth. So as soon as there are solids there, one should remove those, and then the clumping litter to take out the urine. You know, that's at least daily on that. That's the number one way to address this problem with litter box use.
Do you like open or closed boxes?
Oh.
Or I should say, do cats like open or closed boxes?
Yeah, right, yeah. We hear reports enough about cats just being very nervous about a closed box. I mean, that's... You know, cats are used to going out, you know, the outdoor cats, what they go outdoors, find some nice soil, dig a hole, and defecate and urinate, or the, you know, sandbox or whatever. I mean, it's not closed. They're not going to look for a closed place. That's the human comfort thing. Some of our cats are good enough that they'll use it. But if someone comes to me and says, I have a problem with urine marking outside, not urine marking, but defecating, urinating outside the box, I'd say, well, what's the litter box look like? And if it's a closed one, I'd say, well, you got to experiment with an open one, for sure.
Do most cats like clumping litter or unclumping litter, scented or unscented?
Okay, certainly not scented. And forget the liners, the plastic liners, because they have a smell and a feel to it. And clumping litter is the most popular where the tests have been done. You give a cat kind of a selection of different kinds of litter. You know, you put up maybe four different litter boxes and you use a different kind of litter in each one and let them tell you which one they want to use. And a person can do that too. And then they'll tell you. And usually the cats will go for the clumping, you know, fine granulated litter material. But there are cats that choose something that's a bit more coarse, the coarse clay-like. So you can actually have a cat tell you, especially if you've got a problem from time to time with using the litter box.
So set up the smorgasbord and say, here, you tell me what you like.
Right. A cafeteria, litter box cafeteria, different kinds of litter. I mean, you could do it several times over. And the other thing is, Bernadine, that the different cats like different kinds of litter. So you can't just let one cat speak for the whole group. And each cat likes to have its own litter box, too. As you know, you've got to have, you know, one for each litter box for each cat so they don't have to deal with the smells of another cat. And some of my colleagues say it will go, you know, number of litter boxes as you do cats plus one. But main thing is that each cat can have its own litter box and its own choice of litter in the ideal world.
Yeah, and I love that idea. I tell people about it, and I honestly go, oh my goodness, I have three cats. I'm in a condo. That's four litter boxes. There ain't no way, Jose, that I'm doing this. So I have cheated. I'm fortunate that I have a spare bedroom bathroom with a shower bath combo. And I've gotten this huge, it's like a Rubbermaid mixing vat for concrete that fits right in the bathtub. Plug the bathtub, pour 40 pounds of clumping cat litter in there, scoop it twice a day, and knock on wood, my three girls all use the box, and I just keep my paws crossed that they continue to use the box. But yes, I've heard it, and I believe you.
Okay.
Since I have Dr. Ben Hart, board-certified veterinary behaviorist, on the phone, I have my own personal question for you. With my three cats, my kitten right now is about 8 months of age. She's a biter. She bites me. She bites her sister cats. She bites everything. And she's doing this in fun. But how do you get a cat to stop biting?
Well, I can't give you like a 2-minute answer necessarily. Can I? You have to get into details. I mean, okay, when does it bite? What precedes the biting?
She's playing, and I'm probably playing a bit too rough with her, and she loves beating up on her sister, one of her sister kitties.
Okay.
And they tear around the house and just have a blast beating on each other. But then she bites on me when I'm playing with her and loving her and just trying to be gentle kitty love. She'll bite me.
Okay. So it could be that either you reach a point where she's had too much, or it kind of switches something in her own mind, if you will. Something switches, and then she's going to bite, which is a way of signaling, okay, that's enough, let's get out of here, or quit this game. You're mentioning a little bit like this petting-induced aggressive behavior, where people have a cat that likes to be on their lap, and they're petting it, and maybe the cat's purring, and all of a sudden they feel the claws dig in, and then if they keep trying to hold the cat will turn on them and hiss, or even bite, and then jump off. And we don't understand the basis of that behavior. It's just that you reach a point of where the petting induces some sort of aggressive reaction. And there's no physiological or behavioral explanation for it. And the treatment, of course, is just to recognize the signs. Learn to recognize the signs when that cat is likely to be triggered into an aggressive mode from the mode that it was in just before that.
So in other words, it's a cat. So know your cat.
Exactly. Now, before we leave the topic, I want to say one thing about litter boxes.
All right.
We were talking about litter boxes.
Yes.
Okay. And I mentioned that you could rank cats from most to least with regard to urine marking. Now, as it turns out, you can say something about litter box use also. The domestic short hair was ranked highest on litter box use, the easiest to train to litter box use. And the Persian, the least. Those are a couple of things to keep in mind. The Persian, known for problems with litter box. Now, this is feline practitioners telling us, and when they're ranked, that people complain about the problems with litter boxes. The Persian is the least easily trained or easily kept trained to a litter box use.
So, Dr. Hart, in your book, Your Ideal Cat, do you have like a little Excel spreadsheet that says, okay, if you want for family cat, it's these, and if you want for house urine marking to avoidance, it's this cat and this particular breed. Do you have a spreadsheet in there?
We don't have a spreadsheet, but we have something better than a spreadsheet.
I love it.
We have 12 bar graphs, and people are very used to understanding bar graphs. The bar graphs have a scientific basis. Bar graphs that the length of the bar. And that's what I've got. I've got it open right now. I've got it open to litter box use. That's where I'm reading off the information I've given you. The bar, and they go from, we have our 15 purebreds plus the domestic short hair and the long hair. And so you could just say, okay, how about friendliness towards visitors? What about, furniture scratching? There's one here on furniture scratching. What about the friendliness towards visitors? What about fearfulness? You know, you get the cats, you don't care if they're friendly, but you don't like them hiding in the furniture all the time. We have a graph on that one. So we've got 12 behavior traits with the bar graphs. And then you can turn to the breeds, and you can look at each breed has a bar graph for each that points off all 12 of these traits. So if you look at we're talking about the Bengal. Poor Bengal gets a lot of bad rap here, but they're such a beautiful cat.
They're gorgeous.
They are, really. And I'm looking at the bar graph here, and the bars go up to 10. They go down to 1. You know, aggression to family, other cats, activity level, they're up there at 10. They lead the group. Furniture scratching, they lead the group. And then down here, affection, they're at 1. So you can look at that, now recognizing there's individual differences. But now I'll turn to the bar graphs on the Burmese. And affection towards family, that bar is up there at the number 7 level. So they're above average in affection towards family. And here's litter box use, they're above 8, a score of 8 out of 10. So they are very good towards litter box use. And then they're kind of moderate and everything else. So all the breeds have their own bar graphs that go with them.
Well, some people listening to right now would think, Dr. Ben Hart, he's only into cats. How about dogs? What have you done for people understanding their dogs?
Oh, we've done quite a bit. You know, as a veterinary behaviorist, the people that bring you their pets to help you, have you help them solve the problems.
But you've written books about dogs also.
Oh, right. But 3/4 of the problem behaviors presented to us are from dogs, not cats. So you see problem behaviors in dogs a lot. And we've written a book, Your Perfect Puppy. It's actually now out of print. It was sold very well while it was in print. It's now out of print, and we've got a whole new data set with bar graphs and everything. We're trying to just getting that lined up to get published now. And we'll cover 80 breeds of dogs with the same format, interviewing veterinarians and getting ranked. But we don't have that book is not out. We have a book that meant for veterinarians as well as dog owners and cat owners. It's called Canine and Feline Behavior Therapy. And that's a very useful book on all the problem behaviors, and it also includes some normal behavior. And that book's available. It's a 2006 book, and you get that through Amazon, Canine and Feline Behavior Therapy. And you can, you know, can read all the difficult areas of problem behaviors, and then there's a background for each one. So you're going to deal with house soiling. It'll tell you something about cats and house soiling and some of the theoretical thinking behind clean the box often, but you don't want to get a brand new plastic box, you know, things like that that make sense from the background of the cat.
There's just so much to know about these guys. The last thing I want you to touch on just really briefly, and this, I think, surprises a lot of people. I love watching it myself. So why do cats like kitty marijuana catnip?
Well, that's a good question. Believe it or not, in the back of our book.
It is so much fun when they do.
Yeah. You know, in the back of our book, we do a chapter called Why Do They Do That? Why do cats purr? Why do they yawn? Why do they eat grass? And why do they flip out on catnip?
And why do they always have to spit up a hairball on the carpet and not on something that's easy to clean? That has to be in there, too.
That is. We don't have that one covered. There's another thing I want to mention here, but I'll just give you the short answer on the catnip. There is not a good behavioral reason, because we can't. Normally, when you've got it, you put an animal and a plant together with a reaction. You can say, well, there's some sort of evolutionary thing. The catnip plant evolved on a different continent than the ancestor of the domestic cat. So when they were evolving, they were not mixed together at all. So it looks as though then you've got the transportation and global trade and everything was started 100 years ago. People bring catnip and cats together, and you get this reaction. It's just a weird reaction. It's the only animal that really reacts like that. It has to do with the smell, not eating it. And they smell, and about 50% of the cats have this reaction. They play with it. They make sexual responses. Maybe they roll like a female, like a post-copulatory response. They kind of bat it around. They chew it like they're attacking a mouse. It's kind of like it triggers different neural circuits in the brain. Then they habituate. It's over with. And they kind of satiate. And then after an hour or so, they can get back to catnip again. It is just a strange reaction of bringing the plant and the animal together that did not evolve together.
Well, Dr. Hart, I would love to get into this more, but I have to say we're going to have to cut this one short right now. If people want to learn more about these marvelous animals, the one that I have on my lap right now, best thing to do is to get your book, Your Ideal Cat. Where can they find it?
Well, you can get it. Amazon is about the best place. It's published by Purdue University Press. You can buy it from them, but most people are used to ordering things from Amazon. That's probably the best way to get it.
Great. Dr. Ben Hart, thank you so much. I know we're going to have to do this one more time, talking about your ideal puppy and how to bring that puppy in and learning how to make that addition to the family work out as best as possible, because you want to keep them in the house. Once you adopt them, it's for life. You've been listening to Dr. Bernadine Cruz and Dr. Ben Hart. This is the Pet Doctor. Thank you very much for listening. Please tune in again next week. We'll have more information on how to make you the best possible pet owner. Thanks for listening. Take care.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.